Welcome to our year-end edition of Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Bob Beck. In this program, we'll be replaying some of our significant stories from the past year. We begin with a story that first aired in June. Restorative justice is an approach to dealing with crime that put the victim of the crime front and center and considers how the offense affected the community rather than looking at it as an isolated incident. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov had a three-part series about restorative justice efforts in Wyoming. We'll play parts one and two, starting with a case study.
I'm Representative Stephen Watt from Rock Springs, Wyoming.
My name is Mark Farnham. I'm an inmate at the Torrington Medium Security Institution, and I'm the man that shot Steve Watt 31 years ago.
March 18th, 1982. I was a Wyoming State Trooper. 26 years old.
For me, it starts a year or two earlier. I was going to college at the University of Minnesota, and I was selling cocaine, and I was using more than I was selling, and I got deeply in debt, and I just couldn't get out of debt, so I decided to come out to Wyoming to work in the oil fields to pay off the debts. The oil fields didn't work out very well, and one day my rent was due. The tires are bald in the car, and there's no money. And everybody wants their money that I'd been owing for several years all at the same time. So I decided to go rob a bank.
On the 18th of March, I was assigned to attend a funeral for a Rock Springs City officer's son. And so as I dressed that morning, I decided not to wear my bulletproof vest, something I wore every single day.
So I robbed the bank. When I came out of the bank, I was surprised within 10 minutes they had the bank robbery on the AM radio, and I thought for sure I was going to be caught.
While I was having lunch, my dispatcher called and told me that there had been an armed robbery down in Craig, Colorado. She gave me a description of the man and told me that a man fitting that description had been seen around the Wyoming-Colorado state line driving a red sports car.
And I thought, okay, I'm going to make it. I'm going to get away because they had the wrong description of the wrong car.
And I went south of Rock Springs to look for this red sports car. And here come a little brown compact, and I decided to stop that vehicle and ask the man if he had seen this bank robber, and it turned out he was the bank robber.
As soon as he got behind me and turned on his lights, I stepped on the brakes immediately when I jumped out, and I shot twice at his head, hit him once in the eye, and the other bullet went to the side of his head. Then I walked up to the side of his car, and I emptied my gun into him, and he kicked out at me, and I turned around and left him for dead, and I went back to my car.
That's when I got out of my car and went to the front of my car and drew my gun, and my first bullet hit the little metal bar in the center of the headrest and ricocheted down and hit him in the left shoulder, which knocked him forward and to the right out of the way of the next five bullets, which would have hit him in the chest cavity. So my first bullet saved his life.
I'd been shot, and I didn't get far, probably about a mile.
3 miles, exactly.
Okay. So I wasn't going forward. My car was shot up. I'm not out running the police cars, and I'm out in the middle of the desert. So I got out, grabbed the money, and I started running across the desert with the gun in my hand and the money. And so by this time, a number of police agencies started showing up. And I laid in a little gully, wasn't very deep, probably 12 inches. And I looked down, and I had three bullets in my gun. And there was five officers in a semicircle out maybe 50 yards from me. And behind them, there was another 10 or 15 officers and more coming. And I said, this is not going to work. And I gave up at that point.
And an ambulance came and got me, of course, and so we ended up in the hospital right next to each other with just a curtain between us.
And they took me right to the jail as soon as they took the bullet out, and I went to jail.
They did 8 hours worth of surgery on me, sewing everything up, all the holes in my intestines and stomach, and cut out part of my liver and took my eye out. So the surgery was 8 hours. I was in intensive care for 3 days, a regular room for 5 days, and then they let me out. It took me about 2 months to get all completely healed up. Now I turned into an alcoholic, and I was taking painkillers, and I become addicted to the painkillers too. The post-traumatic stress that I suffered from the shooting, I couldn't get past my hatred and my anger and my bitterness, and the nightmares were awful, and it just wore me out. And so I left the highway patrol and went to California and became a law enforcement chaplain out there. I'd become a Christian before I went to California. The whole time when I was struggling, drinking and painkillers and hating Mark, my wife said to me, "I don't know how long I can live in your hatred, Steve." She told me, "Why don't you forgive Mark?" And I said, "I have." And she told me I was a liar. And finally, I called the chaplain and I said, "What's wrong with me? How come I have no joy as a Christian?" And he said, "Well, why don't you forgive Mark?" And I said, "I did." And he called me a liar, and I hung up on him. And a few days later, I called him back. And he said, "Why don't you just write him a letter and tell him what's on your heart?" And I prayed about it, and I just put the pen to a piece of paper, and I wrote, I believe, what God wanted me to write. And the exact words in my letter, I'll never forget them, were, "Mark, I don't wish pain by sending these to you. I just want to share my joy with you. If you haven't already, won't you join me in Christ's love in the Christian family?" And I signed my name, and I shipped it off.
It was a big shock first. I was glad to hear from him. In fact, Steve will tell you, my first letter back was 17 pages long.
18.
Okay. So we started corresponding. We corresponded for 9 months. And
I had left California and come to Wyoming, and I was traveling around sharing my story in churches. Well, the Methodist minister called me up and said, "There's a Christian revival down in Rawlins. Do you want to go? The guy that shot you will be there." I said, "Absolutely not. I'm not ready for this." And all of a sudden I went, "Oh man, I can't take this feeling. Yeah, I'll go." And it was like God lifted that weight off of me. And then we went into the prison, and I walked into the gymnasium, and the door opened on the other side, and the inmates walked in, and there was Mark.
I went up to shake his hand, and he gave me this big bear hug. And we talked for about an hour at that revival. And then after that, we continued to write, and I put Steve on my visiting list. And his kids grew up in the visiting room coming, seeing me. For a while, I was at the Honor Farm, and they would bring picnic baskets up there. And
they have barbecues.
Barbecues. And one of the strange things, I think, about this relationship is the normalcy. When he comes to spend time with me, or we write letters, or we talk on the phone, or we work on projects together, the first thing that we think about is not the shooting that day. We think about whatever's at hand at that moment, that project, that whatever we're working on.
Or the future.
Or the future, yeah.
Yeah.
Love is absolutely at the center. Christ is at the center. Shared values.
Mm-hmm.
Compassion.
Political views.
Oh, no, no. Steve is a little to the right of Genghis Khan for all you Republicans out there. And I'm a little to the left of Obama. So,
But yeah, I've gotten more out of this than probably I think Mark has.
In the first part, we heard from Stephen Watt and Mark Farnham about how they became unlikely friends after Farnham shot Watt over 30 years ago. Today, as friends, one of the things that bonds them is pushing for restorative justice practices within the criminal justice system. In this second part, we hear how, for now, Wyoming has limited options for those seeking restorative justice counseling in the state.
To start, what is restorative justice?
The underlying basis of restorative justice is to repair the harm that's been done in a crime.
That's Richard Prince, a trained facilitator in restorative justice.
It's not so much the issue that a law has been broken as it is that people have been hurt. And so what restorative justice seeks to do is repair the harm that has been done to the victim and also to the community that was involved in the crime.
Victims coordinator for the Wyoming Board of Parole, Randy Lasalu, adds that victims are a more central focus in restorative justice counseling.
In the regular criminal justice system, sometimes I see the victims just being put aside, and they're not really brought in as much as they should be or would like to be. I mean, it's their only time to really have a say.
The way it works is victim and offender are brought together for a one-time meeting to speak about the offense itself and their respective experiences after it. The victim has to request the meeting, and the facilitator does a lot of prep work to get both victim and offender ready to meet again. The state currently has no such programs for adults, just one for youth in Fremont County. But both Lasalu and Prince are working to bring more restorative justice counseling to the state. So far, Lasalu has done one session.
The outcome of the one last year was, like, ideal. They hugged the offender told the victim, you know, what he was planning on doing, which was some really great things. And it was basically, you know, kind of what the victim was hoping for, that he had turned his life around and was moving towards the positive.
Prince says that for the victims, the meetings can also be an opportunity to get closure.
The victim may have a period of peace or a period of rest while the offender is in prison. But as soon as the offender gets released again, then the fear and everything rises back up because there was never any closure. The victims always have the questions, why did you do what you do? I don't understand. This is how you made me feel.
Prince has offenders benefit as well. He thinks it's important to salvage people who have done wrong instead of continuing to fill our prisons. The idea of salvaging is perhaps more poignantly told by Patty Grunland, a juvenile probation officer with Fremont County Youth Services.
This is a way that we can really divert juveniles out of the adult criminal court system.
Grunland uses restorative justice methods when dealing with youth who get into trouble. She thinks it's more effective than any traditional punitive methods.
The trend is they don't reoffend. They don't get tickets.
She works exclusively with youth who've committed misdemeanors, but there is similar data for all types of offenders and offenses. Grunland told about one of her first restorative justice sessions where she met with two young men and their neighbor who they had robbed. In that case, she says, the woman walked away after the meeting with her fear of the boys assuaged, and the boys were able to get a new perspective.
Because before it was just some old lady that lived next door. They didn't know her. And so for them, they could really identify that, well, this is like my grandma. This is like my family member. This is something that somebody could have done to my grandmother. They were able to share with the victim their apologies, their reasonings, their intent to make it right.
Still, Grunland says this methodology is not appropriate in every case, and Prince maintains that such efforts are in addition to the existing criminal justice system.
Prisons are going to be necessary. Jails are going to be necessary. The current justice system, the way we have it, it is necessary. Restorative justice is not to replace what we have. It's to work hand in hand with what we have. But at the same time, restorative justice is to bring out the people who we're throwing away in prison that we really shouldn't be throwing away.
In some states, restorative justice methods are used before sentencing, and eventually programs like that could help contain the swelling prison system, save money, and, in Prince's words, salvage more people. But for now, Wyoming is starting out small. LaSalle has received the go-ahead from the Board of Parole to develop the protocol for a victim-offender dialogue program and will attend a training in September. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Since this story first aired, LaSalle, along with several volunteers, attended a training for restorative justice mediators and says the program should be up and running at the start of 2014. When we come back, we revisit a story on suicide and hear an uplifting education story from Jackson. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Irina Zhurov. September was Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. Wyoming consistently has one of the highest rates of suicide in the nation, and the state is working hard to change that. One of the reasons that suicide prevention efforts are so important is because of what suicide does to the family and friends of the victim. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reported that the grief survivors go through can be much more acute than other types of grief.
On December 10th, 2010, it occurred to Dan Hedrick that he hadn't heard from his brother in several weeks. That wasn't altogether odd. His brother was a solitary person, mostly kept to himself. But for some reason, Hedrick found himself wondering if everything was okay.
The next day, I was headed into town. My phone rang, and my mom said, can you come up to the house? Your brother shot himself.
When Hedrick got to the house, the police were already there. There was no note, but the coroner said it looked like a suicide. Hedrick says he's still trying to wrap his head around why his brother killed himself.
He had had an injury on an accident with Union Pacific that really wasn't covered and was in a lot of pain. That's the story we tell ourselves. As a survivor, you keep trying to grasp at straws to make sense of it.
Hedrick says not knowing why his brother killed himself has been one of the hardest things to deal with. After his brother's death, he did his best to be strong, to help his mother and sister cope with the loss. But in the process, he bottled up his grief until it finally bubbled to the top.
I got to the point that I was constantly annoyed with everything without knowing why I was annoyed. Simple things would make me mad and cause me to react in ways that I normally wouldn't react.
And little things would bring back the pain, like his brother's new driver's license arriving in the mail.
6 weeks after he passed away, up pops a letter with congratulations, you've got your license, and a picture of him just before he died. You know, there's always those little things that kind of trigger the pain coming out.
Anyone who's had a loss goes through a cycle of grief. But UW psychology professor Carolyn Pepper says suicide survivors often have added emotional trauma.
They're also probably experiencing feelings of rejection and abandonment, wondering, why did this person do this to me? And that can go along with anger. They might have guilt, wondering if there's something that they should have done, if they should have seen this coming and done something differently.
And there's often a sense of isolation because friends don't necessarily know how to respond.
So even their friends sometimes pull away because they don't quite know what to say or how to be of help.
Pepper says survivors often feel a sense of shame, and so they avoid talking about what happened.
It's a hard thing to say, my brother killed himself.
You know, the thing we struggle with suicide is that there's stigma around suicide.
Teresa Humphreys-Wadsworth is the state suicide prevention coordinator. She says people often assume that someone who commits suicide has some sort of character flaw, and she says that keeps survivors and their friends from talking about it openly. Pepper says that makes it harder to get through the grief, harder to heal.
That could lead into things like depression, alcohol and drug abuse problems if they're trying to use substances to numb the pain, and even in some cases, suicide themselves.
But Humphreys-Wadsworth is optimistic that things will change.
You know, it hasn't been that many years ago that we couldn't say the word cancer, that was a word we whispered behind our hand when someone died. And now people talk about it openly. And I know that at some point that's where we're going to be with suicide deaths.
Humphreys-Wadsworth says what's needed is a major public education campaign. She says people need to understand that suicide victims are not flawed human beings. They just can't see any other way to get past the problems in their lives.
Once we understand that, it takes away that judgment that goes along with stigma.
And she says when that happens, survivors may start to talk more openly about what's happened and get the support they need to recover from the loss. The state is already working to educate people about the warning signs for suicide and teach them how to help if someone is considering ending their life. And Humphreys-Wadsworth hopes to expand those efforts in the future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Roughly 3 years ago, two women undertook an effort to take a group of middle school girls in Jackson under their wing with the goal of helping them get into college. The effort is called College Bound Latinas, and the program has had some early success. But a recent interaction with a University of Wyoming professor is taking the girls even further, as Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Because of the large number of tourist-related jobs in Teton County, the Mexican population has been increasing over the last 20 years. It's led to a large influx of Latino children into the school system. But because they are learning a second language and adapting to a new culture, some of them have struggled. A few years ago, local Head Start director Letty Lira and Isabel Zumel from the Teton County Library decided to start a new group called College Bound Latinas to try and address the problem. Their goal was to take a group of 7th grade girls and help them get into college. The plan was to work with the girls over the summer. Lira remembers that some thought their idea was crazy.
Many of the adults that we had around us told us, these girls are never going to come. They're never going to show up on Saturdays on a summer. This is not going to happen.
Not only did it happen, but the 13 girls who initially showed up were very enthusiastic.
What they needed were high expectations, and they needed positive attention as well.
Student Kelly Marr says the positive attention was lacking in the school district, and the personal interaction made a big difference.
Before I met Letty and Isabel, I was like so lost. I knew that school was really important for me, but this time I'm not lost. I know what I want to do, and so they have really helped me in that.
In an effort to introduce them to college life, the College Bound Latinas then came to the University of Wyoming and were invited to interact with a class taught by Educational Studies professor Aurora Chang. Chang was impressed with the girls, and it led to the development this summer of an intensive writing program called the Emerging Latina Scholars Intensive Writing Institute. It took place during 5 days in June.
And many of them were quick to tell me that they hadn't written that much in pretty much all of the time that they had been in school. And so originally they weren't too happy with me.
Student Laura Perez says that Chang's approach caught them off guard.
So first she made us write just free writing, and she read them. The next day she technically told us that our writing sucked. That just made us hate her a bit because no teacher has ever told us that.
But it had the desired result.
So that just made us push ourselves even harder to just write better and look at our work and see what we did.
The girls wrote a 10 to 12 page personal biography along with other writing activities. They even read and analyzed college level articles. Kelly Mars admits she learned a lot and improved, even though writing is not something she generally enjoys.
I like writing a little bit more, but not that much.
Chang says, though, that her tough approach will help.
In the end, they understood the value. It's not about liking folks. It's not about liking me. It's about you all getting to college and us doing whatever it takes to not only get to college, but also persevere through college.
By the way, Chang says the girls improved immensely and says they responded well to the challenges.
I think they are really intelligent, and they understand that good things take really hard work.
The girls will be in 10th grade this year. Chang is including them in her personal research, and she does plan to challenge the girls even more in coming years. Co-founders Letty Lira and Isabel Zumel says that they plan similar programs with other students in the future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, we'll look at the importance of reopening sawmills and whether coal gasification is a waste of time. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to our year-end edition of Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Bob Beck. Sawmills are reopening in Wyoming and Colorado after a decade of being shuttered. They're harvesting and processing trees that have been killed by beetle infestation. Still, many are suitable for lumber. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez reported that this uptick in the timber business is helping with forest fire management.
On a densely wooded slope of Elk Mountain in Carbon County, a huge logging machine sets about clear-cutting a stand of lodgepole pines and fir trees. It has an enormous mechanical arm wielding a claw and a circular saw. In a few smooth motions, it slices through several trees a few stories high, gently lifts them, and places them in a tidy bunch. This device that fells and bunches trees is called a feller buncher.
The equipment that the loggers use is very expensive, and just the labor that goes into it. If it weren't for having the sawmills in the area, we wouldn't be able to do hardly any forest management.
Josh Van Vlack is with the Wyoming State Forestry Division. He says the area's new sawmill, Saratoga Forest Management, makes it possible to clear out hundreds of acres of beetle-killed wood. The company sells the wood in the form of 2x4s and wood chips, and the forestry division gets help clearing out swaths of dense forest. Van Vlack points out that half the forest is already dead.
The mountain pine beetle has attacked the lodgepole pine and the ponderosa pine at a pretty much landscape scale.
The region has seen serious wildfires spreading in recent years that have threatened cities and taken lives. Foresters blame poor management over the last century. Historically, extinguishing fires was the priority, which allowed forests to grow denser. Then, in reaction to overharvesting, environmental restrictions drastically limited timber sales. Brian Farabee with the U.S. Forest Service's Rocky Mountain region added that these factors have enabled a feeding frenzy among native bark beetles.
The host beetles have just taken advantage of a combination of climate change, drought, and the lack of vegetation treatment across the landscape, and has really spread.
To make matters worse, competition from Canada and a weak domestic construction market forced many regional sawmills out of business in the early 2000s. This January, one of the biggest sawmills in the region came back to life. Clint George is one of the owners of Saratoga Forest Management. He says once you eliminate fire and harvesting,
what you end up with is densely spaced forests where the trees are competing for nutrients, and therefore they're susceptible to disease, they're susceptible to insects, they're susceptible to fires.
The rash of beetle kill and rapidly spreading wildfires were game changers for the timber industry. Last year, the Forest Service sold off nearly four times as much timber as it had in 2000. They're selling marketable timber to sawmills and hiring loggers to strategically cut down the less valuable but more dangerous stuff. Sawmills benefit because beetle-killed wood is just as strong as regular wood. And Saratoga's Clint George says federal, state, and private forest managers are happy because thinning wooded areas can also improve forest health, much like fire did naturally.
And so we can go out into the forest, and when we harvest, it opens up the forest floor. The seeds now that are dropped during the process, the pine cones open up, the seeds start to regenerate, and you have a regeneration of the forest.
Saratoga Forest Management is processing about 25 million feet of logs per year. Owners say that if more timber becomes available, the mill could handle three times that much, removing even more fuel from the regional forests. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
Clean coal has been on the lips of those interested in energy for many years. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports that those ideas rarely go anywhere.
Over the years, many researchers have looked at a variety of research and economic development projects using Wyoming coal. The idea is to open up new markets for it and to make it more viable for businesses and the public to use. Much of this has surrounded coal gasification. There's been a belief that coal could be used as a form of liquid fuel. That was especially useful when oil supplies appeared limited in the United States. But as the country entered a technology revolution and opened up more resources, the interest dropped. Experts say that the reason interest has waned is because these projects never work out.
You understand that I think coal to liquids is a schlock deal. It is. It'll never fly.
That's University of Wyoming Emeritus Professor E.G. Jerry Meyer. Meyer has done plenty of coal research over the years, but he says efforts like the DKRW coal-to-gas proposal for Carbon County will never get anywhere. DKRW is the most recent effort at turning coal into liquid fuel. Meyer says such projects are very capital-intensive to produce something that cheaper oil and natural gas can already be used for. He says when you then realize that you also need to deal with CO2 that's produced, it can get very expensive.
So when you add up the whole thing, you understand you need two plants, which represents a large capital investment. When you understand that the process is not efficient, you ask yourself, does this really make sense? And the answer is no.
Another longtime University of Wyoming professor who studied coal-to-liquids efforts is Harold Bergman. Bergman says Wyoming actually was heavily involved with coal-to-liquids efforts in the 70s when the country was dealing with the oil embargo. But he says the plants at the time found out that there was a lot of liquid waste created from those efforts, which was problematic. And when the oil crisis ended, so did the interest in coal-to-gasoline. Various other coal experiments were floated through the years. In the 90s, as a member of the Wyoming Environmental Quality Council and later as head of the Ruckelshaus Institute on Environment and Natural Resources, Bergman saw a number of coal projects come and go.
These coal gasification, liquefaction, and oil shale retorting operations all collapsed because of cost.
Ben Avery of the Wyoming Business Council says most of the efforts to liquefy coal either came from researchers, non-coal companies, or the federal government. But when the research is finished, the projects come to an end.
I have yet to see a business plan on one of these coal-to-liquid facilities.
Avery says the same goes for other value-added coal projects.
We've got companies interested in doing that underground coal gasification, capturing the CO2, and doing that for enhanced oil recovery, using the CO2 for enhanced oil recovery. Seems to potentially be perhaps a little less capital-intensive cost than the coal to liquid.
Whether that amounts to anything remains to be seen, but the intentions are there. Professor Bergman says diversifying Wyoming's economy and finding new ways to try to save what's becoming a declining coal market is a reason for it, but still a bad idea. He says research dollars can be better spent elsewhere.
The DKRW or other coal to liquids or coal to gas operations seem to me to be environmentally and economically foolhardy to the extreme.
While some point out that South Africa has had success with such projects, Bergman notes that it came at a time when South Africa was cut off from the rest of the world and needed coal to liquids for fuel. And for those looking at ways to use U.S. coal differently in the current market, Bergman is skeptical.
Now there's so much cheap gas in the world because of the production of gas from fracking that even to make plastics or some other product out of coal, it's still going to be way, way cheaper to just use natural gas.
As mentioned earlier, UW Emeritus Professor Jerry Meyer does believe that some coal research makes sense, and he's in favor of efforts to break up the molecules in coal and use it for commerce. Meyer says if you want to do something new with coal, this is the best approach.
We will use coal as it should be used, as a raw material to produce chemicals and char. Char is another form of carbon. It can be used not only as a fuel, but it can be used as an adsorbent in such things as gas masks, in reducing pollutants.
One last point about all these coal research efforts. Very few of these ideas are coming from those directly involved in the coal industry. Meyer notes that coal companies do not have the research teams that oil companies employ. While researchers and others look at doing new things with coal, he says coal companies are, quote, dig it and ship it guys. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, a story on using science to make policy and air pollution in Converse County. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Bob Beck. Science has long been something we look to for answers. But when it comes to policymaking, science can't always provide the clear solutions lawmakers and the public want. That has to do with how science works and the politics that sometimes infiltrate. Two issues in Wyoming demonstrate uncannily well the shortcomings of science when it comes to decision-making in the environmental sphere. Irina Zhurov has more.
Remember that scene in Ghostbusters when Bill Murray's character is pursuing a seemingly irrelevant line of questioning with a laid-out woman as a concerned man stands by?
Are you, Alice, menstruating right now?
What has that got to do with it?
Back off, man. I'm a scientist.
We have this reverence for science, this trust. But what if we can't always turn to science? What if science is sometimes as sleazy as Bill Murray in Ghostbusters? Who to trust then? In Wyoming, this is a very real question right now. Take, for example, the issue of contaminated water in Pavilion. The Environmental Protection Agency came out with a study tentatively linking the contamination in Pavilion to fracking. Industry and the state said EPA's study was flawed and are now starting work on their own study. If science is science, then why would the state's results be any different from the EPA's?
If science was science and it was independent, in other words, nobody had an interest in the outcome, then you're right, there's no problem.
That's Andrew Rosenberg, who directs the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
There is no methodology that is perfect. So if there are methodological issues, what might be the consequences of those methodological issues, and what would be a more appropriate way that would deal with those consequences? In other words, are there biases in the results or not? So do the independent review without conflict of interest, as opposed to backing away and handing it off to organizations that clearly have a conflict of interest.
Arguably, Wyoming has a vested interest in the production of oil and natural gas. But let's suppose, for argument's sake, that science is science after all. Even then, there are issues.
An honest scientific opinion is sometimes hard to come by because of the uncertainty.
Harold Bergman is a professor at the University of Wyoming. He says even in good science, there's the caveat of uncertainty. Something, by the way, that Pavilion has a lot of.
So within that range of uncertainty, what we tend to do as human beings or as regulatory bodies and sometimes as scientists, We tend to add our personal values or our government values to decide whether or not the answer is on this end of the uncertainty range or on that end of the uncertainty range.
And the interpretation of the uncertainty could be ripe for politicking. Take, for example, another issue in the state. Encana Oil and Gas is asking for an exemption to be able to pump wastewater into the Madison Aquifer. Encana modeled the process and concluded that it would be safe. Then, the Powder River Basin Resource Council, an environmental group whose agenda is quite different from Encana's, contracted Tom Myers, an independent hydrologist, to review Encana's work, which he did, and tentatively concluded it was not so safe. But
remember, I mean, my study is a very cursory examination using some very basic numbers.
There's a reason Myers' analysis was cursory.
I cannot say whether Encana is correct or not correct, because there is just no transparency to what they did.
Everybody agrees that science needs to be transparent to be trustworthy. Rosenberg of the Center for Science and Democracy also says any science needs to be peer-reviewed, something neither Encana nor the state have committed to in either the Pavilion work or the Madison Aquifer exemption modeling. So where does this leave policymakers and the public? Do they trust the EPA's work when deciding on policy? The states? Encana's? Myers? Bergman says how we use our science is a philosophical question. Europe, he says, uses the precautionary principle, which leans towards absolute protection when there isn't enough information.
In the United States, by law, almost all of our environmental regulatory laws rely instead on risk analysis or risk-benefit analysis. And so there we're trying to get enough information to be able to make a parsed judgment about the probability of something being bad.
Risk-benefit analysis requires a lot of data. Sometimes so much, everyone will privately tell you that it's not feasible to obtain. That might just be the case in Pavilion. So the uncertainty could remain a crutch both sides can lean on there. Meanwhile, data or no data, regulations still have to be made. Former Governor Dave Friedenthal says the dance between politicians and scientists is an ongoing one.
The availability of scientific information is desirable, but it isn't always present when you have to make the decision. And sometimes what you do is you make the decision on the best available information. And you see that in the environmental area, best available control technology, maximum achievable control technology. What you see is an admission that public policy and science move at different rates.
Friedenthal oversaw the sage-grouse saga in the state and implemented rules to protect the bird. He says they used the best available science, knowing it wasn't perfect.
The difficulty is that public policy and emotions may move faster than science. The other thing is that public policy and politics want clearly black and white answers. Science tends to be shades of gray.
And sometimes that gray gets even murkier when special interests are involved. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Converse County has seen an increasing amount of energy development, and some residents worry that air quality could suffer as a result. The Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality and researchers from the University of Wyoming are now monitoring air quality in the area. On the whole, they found that the air is pretty clean, but they've also documented times when pollution levels have spiked. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
The concern that some residents and environmentalists have is that emissions from oil and gas development could lead to unhealthy levels of pollution. That's happened before, for example, around Pinedale. In that area, emissions from the natural gas industry caused a type of pollution called ozone to form, to a point where it violated federal air quality standards. So when oil wells started popping up near residential areas in Converse County, some people got nervous.
They have concerns about the air quality related to that oil and gas development, so that's why we decided to place a monitoring trailer there.
Kara Kessler supervises the air quality monitoring program for the Department of Environmental Quality. She says DEQ placed a monitoring station in Converse County last year to find out how clean the air is and to make sure any pollution doesn't exceed legal limits. The Bureau of Land Management also commissioned an air quality study in the area. They're expecting applications for more oil and gas drilling on federal land, and they want to use the data they're collecting to model how air quality might change with increased development. Karis Tours is their air quality specialist.
We use our analysis to determine if we authorize further development. Is it going to add to that problem? And, you know, we certainly can't authorize anything that's going to violate an air quality standard.
The researcher who's conducting the study for the BLM is Rob Field. He's an atmospheric scientist at UW, and he's done extensive research into the ozone problem around Pinedale. He says so far in Converse County, there's good news. Pollution levels have been relatively low.
We've not encountered the level of emission plumes that certainly we found in the Pinedale Anticline project area. Will that change in the future? That's the question. That's why we're performing some more of these monitoring circuits and see how the air quality may evolve over time.
There were some instances where pollution levels spiked, though. One day in July, there was a lot of ozone in the air, and for a few days in August, there were high concentrations of carbon monoxide. Christy Mogan lives near Douglas. She says her family certainly noticed the pollution.
It was just really hard to breathe, and we were kind of thinking, well, did we catch a cold or something? It was just very hard to breathe. We've lived out there since 2004. We haven't ever felt like we couldn't breathe the air.
Nobody knows whether those pollution episodes had anything to do with the oil and gas industry. And the data that DEQ has collected this year does not indicate that federal air quality standards have been violated. One ozone episode does not constitute a violation, and this one wasn't specific to Converse County. High ozone levels were reported in Casper, Cheyenne, and parts of Colorado around the same time. So Kara Kessler with DEQ says residents shouldn't be alarmed.
No, I don't think we need to be concerned about violating the ozone standard at this point in time.
But just because air quality standards are okay now doesn't mean there couldn't be a problem in the future, given that more energy development is expected. Rob Field says he found that baseline levels of ozone in the area, in other words, the levels of ozone that are present pretty much all the time, were relatively high.
So you don't have to add very much ozone to breach a standard level.
In other words, if industry comes in, drills more wells, and creates just a little bit more ozone, it's possible that it could push the area over the legal limit. But we may not know if that happens. That's because it takes 3 years of data to determine if there's an ozone exceedance, and DEQ may not leave its monitoring station in Converse County that long. Again, DEQ's Kara Kessler.
It's pretty likely that it would move somewhere else after a year because we do have other areas that also need investigation. We've never had a case where we've left a trailer there long term just based on that first year of data.
Environmental groups say that's a problem. They feel it's crucial to continue monitoring in an area like this where energy development is on the rise and to analyze the data carefully when permitting new development. Jill Morrison with the Powder River Basin Resource Council says she doesn't want Converse County to become another Pinedale.
The Green River Basin is in a non-attainment status, and that's as a result of natural gas development. We know, given the recent monitoring in the Powder River Basin and around Douglas, you know, we see the ozone values approaching the standard, and we know there's a lot more coming. It's just going to be so important for us to get out in front of this right now and do as much as we can to limit those emissions.
DEQ will complete its initial year of monitoring in December. After that, they'll decide whether to leave their monitoring station in Converse County. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
In recent years, the state legislature has seen an increase in conservative Republicans who are focusing more on personal rights and freedoms. Those rights range from removing federal restrictions on gun laws to voting against anything that might resemble a tax. They've had mixed success with this approach, but they see their role in the state legislature as important. But others wonder if they're consistent. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
I've tried to keep people's liberty in the forefront of my thinking, and I hope I've been able to do that, so it's something I think about every day.
That's State Senator Cale Case of Lander. The Republican has served in the legislature for 20 years. Case is extremely fiscally conservative and is not a big fan of laws in general.
I cast a lot of no votes, and that's because I believe that what we're doing is either unnecessary or interferes with decisions that really ought to be left privately with individuals.
Many Republicans are cautious when it comes to legislation, but Case needs to be completely sold before he votes for something. It appears that Case will stray from his thinking when it comes to the occasional civil rights or environmental cause, but his standard is to do what's best for the state as a whole. Over in the House of Representatives sits Kendall Croker. The 39-year-old from Evansville is in his second term in the House and has quickly established himself as one of the growing number of young conservative voices that have been elected in recent years. Croker owns a motorcycle dealership, so he's worried about laws that impact small businesses. But he says the primary reason he's in the legislature is to protect individual freedoms. So if he's in doubt, he takes a page out of Case's book.
We as a body try to take it upon ourselves to protect everybody from every harm that will be out there. And a lot of times that's just not possible. The intentions are good, but all that results is really less freedom and less liberty. And so I've always been of the opinion, if I'm not completely sure on a bill and I'm in doubt, I always vote no, because I figure if it's a good idea, we can revisit it again.
But some wonder if Croker isn't a hypocrite. For instance, he has voted for bills that would take away rights from gays and lesbians. And this session, he sponsored a bill that would declare an abortion illegal if a heartbeat could be detected from the fetus.
Like with the abortion issue, I believe that a fetus is a human life and therefore is entitled to the same protection under law, you know, as somebody else. You know, so protecting the life of the unborn to me is just as important as protecting the life and rights of the born.
But recluse Representative Sue Wallace says that's crazy.
Freedom is freedom. I don't want government in my business. I don't want them necessarily overstepping their bounds in my community, and I damn sure don't want them overstepping their bounds and invading my personal space or my neighbors in personal space.
Wallace strongly opposed Croker's abortion bill and was a co-sponsor of legislation that would allow both gay marriage and recognize domestic partnerships in the state. But she is far from liberal. As she stands in the hallway outside the House of Representatives, she points out that she is very fiscally conservative. She's fought for years to deregulate small food vendors, and she's strong on gun rights. In other words, there's days that you're really going to be with her or really against her.
And my hate mail and fan mail will prove that.
But Wallace thinks she is very consistent, and it frustrates her when fellow conservatives think it's okay to meddle in people's lives one day and not the next. Another person who gets frustrated is Dan Neal at the Equality State Policy Center. They strongly support traditionally liberal legislation. Neal says the anti-government approach has cost the state chances to improve health care and public safety.
You know, workplace safety is a classic one where we've insisted that, this state's horrible fatality rate could be reduced by a greater commitment to enforcement. But they'll say, no, we can't have government intrusion in business.
Neal also ridicules the anti-government rhetoric when he notes that the state gets millions in federal money for roads, education, and health care. Lyman Republican Ellen Yagi smiles and says Neal's point is a good one. Yagi has served for 6 years and has dedicated himself to removing federal and state gun regulations. He agrees that the state enjoys too many federal handouts and blames other legislators for their hypocrisy.
I think we're a little bit hypocritical, just exactly what you're pointing out. My solution is let's get away from taking federal money. Of course, I don't think the will of the legislature or of the governor is to stop taking that federal money, because that would hurt our spending.
Back in the Senate, Cale Case is mulling a recent vote where the Senate defeated a bill that would have banned discrimination in the workplace against same-sex couples. He says true conservatives should support that type of legislation because it restores freedoms for more citizens. But Case says the fact that the bill hit the floor is a good sign.
Absolutely. And I think it's stunning. You know, there were bills to deprive people of rights, of, and opportunity before. Now we're seeing, let's put in our law that we're not going to discriminate. I think that's really healthy. It's going to be a good thing. It's all going to be okay.
Case says citizens are way ahead of their legislators on these issues, so they just need to catch up. And he thinks legislators will catch up soon. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck in Cheyenne.
That's our program for this week. We want to thank you for supporting our work throughout the year.
If you want to hear these stories or any of our programs again, you can find them on our website at WyomingPublicMedia.org and click on Open Spaces. You can also use that website to propose future stories or interviews and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor.
If you'd like to follow us on Facebook, you can find us under Wyoming Public Radio News. You can also follow all of our reporters on Twitter. From all of us at Wyoming Public Media, Happy New Year. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.